Hey, everyone. You may have been expecting to see somebody named Amy Walthour. She just had a baby, and she's doing very well with her new daughter, but neither were willing to travel out here to Denver to do this presentation, so the baton was passed to me. And at the time that I created this presentation, I was under the impression that I had no conflict of interest to report, but I've since learned from a colleague that I've been serving for the past 10 years as the chairman of the Georgia Department of Community Health Drug Utilization Review Board. And while it's unpaid and unreimbursed service, I didn't think of it as a conflict because we try to be very objective in our analysis. And if anything, our work on the board has been a policing function for some of the policies that the state Medicaid people have come up with. So in the interest of full disclosure, I will tell you that and let you decide if you think it's a conflict of interest. I do not personally believe it is. What we're going to talk about today is an evaluation of a policy that was implemented for putting prior authorization on medications for schizophrenia. And as you all are well aware, schizophrenia is a very serious mental illness and affects a lot of folks in beginning in early adulthood with symptoms that are from a variety of sources, but positive and negative and cognitive symptoms. And we treat it with drugs that at the very least, sometimes are effective, sometimes they are not. At the worst, they have serious side effects that can be even as debilitating as the disease. The first generation antipsychotics, drugs like haloperidol, have their own set of problems. The second generations of the atypicals, drugs like risperidone, have their problems as well. And as a board, the Georgia Drug Utilization Review Board, we have always believed in and put on the record many times that we believe in open access to drugs and mental health. We think that the best choice needs to be made by the physician in consideration of the specific things going on with that patient. And because different people respond to these drugs in different ways, we think that that's the best approach to take. However, because of problems with these medicines, whether it be their side effects or whether it be their cost, people begin to look at the control of these drug categories. But just so you know, we believe that open access in this mental health category is a good policy. And it's partly why we began to undertake this study. The second generation antipsychotics are extensively marketed drugs, and they're very expensive. And you've probably seen direct-to-consumer advertising on the television or in magazines that relate to these drug categories. In addition to that, state Medicaid programs carry a very big burden of the expense for these medications because of the incidence of schizophrenia and related mental health disorders in that population. And the spending is very high on these drug categories. Now, in addition to that, Georgia is not the only state that has looked at policies to control utilization within these categories. About 23 other states at the time of this study, which coincidentally you'll notice it's around the time of Medicare Part D, and it's around the time that a lot of state Medicaid programs became managed care or went into the managed care arena. So we had some limitations on what we could do because of those issues as well, and we'll talk about that more in just a minute. But in September of 2004, Georgia did implement a prior authorization policy for the atypical antipsychotics in the mental health drug category. So three agents, olanzapine, aripiprazole, and olanzapine with fluoxetine combination, required prior authorization. The good news in Georgia was that patients who were already on any of the medications were grandfathered. So if you had a current prescription, you could keep taking that medication. So we feel like this policy was a very liberal prior authorization policy. It could have been a lot more stringent in terms of everybody must now follow the preferred drug list. So the PA requirements basically were verification of clinical appropriateness if you didn't, if you were a new patient after the policy came on board, and that you did have to trial on a generically available or a first generation antipsychotic agent, not an atypical. So our big question was, has limiting immediate access in this drug category negatively impacted the schizophrenic patients in the Georgia Medicaid program? And basically, you'll see in just a moment, what we looked at were utilization of health services as a proxy for patient care. So we got our data from the Georgia Department of Community Health, which was the Medicaid data, but we also attempted to get data from the Department of Human Resources. It turns out, for example, we wanted to be able to look at incarcerations or deaths, which the Medicaid program did not have that data. the data that we got from DHR was really, it was blatantly non-usable. For example, with incarcerations, there would be a period of 3 months where there'd be no incarcerations whatsoever, and then in the third month, it looked like everybody went to jail, and then a month later, you know, it was completely different. So the data, for whatever reason, we were not able to get on incarcerations or deaths. So that's something that we want to look at in the future. Our study design was basically what's termed an interrupted time series using a segmented regression analysis. And this is a form of, economists would call this a structural change model. We were basically looking at the program before and after the policy implementation to see what the impact on various dependent variables or various outcome measures might be. So we looked at continuously eligible adults age 18 to 85. And again, the Medicare Part D would have complicated this as well as Medicare coverage in general. And then the schizophrenic diagnosis, as well as having at least one prescription during the study period for an atypical antipsychotic. So the study period began on July 1st of 2003, and we had to cut it off in April of 2006, again, because of the structural changes to the Medicaid program and our inability to collect data after that point. So we looked at, the variables that we looked at were physician's office visits and emergency room visits, hospitalizations, and length of stay. Now, these were supposed to be all-cause utilization, but we ended up finding out we had an issue with physician's office visits. Initially, in the Medicaid data, we were told that we did not have access to the data on what's called adult mental health or the secure care system. Secure care is when somebody is arrested and they go, and when they're in jail, the sheriff or whoever decides that they need to see a doctor and they send them off for a psychiatric evaluation. The adult mental health system, we were told the physician visits in there were covered by a different system and not by Medicaid. Unfortunately, that's not true. So that whole piece of the data got left out of our initial analysis, but we do have that data now, and I'll show you what our preliminary findings are with regard to that. So here's the regression model. For those of you who don't like equations and models, I don't either. Amy is much better at doing these things, but the model actually, while it looks complicated, it's very, very simple. We have the dependent variable. For example, we would have hospitalizations on the left-hand side of that model. And then we're just going to look at two equations, two regression models within one that looks at the time period that we're talking about, whether it's pre or post policy. And we're going to look at that over the period of the study to determine if there were changes in the pre-policy period that were different than changes in the post-policy period. So, for example, our regression coefficients, the betas, beta zero would be the baseline level of hospitalizations or whatever health outcome we were looking at before the policy. Beta one would be the trend in that variable before the policy. Two and three would just be those same variables after the policy change. And for example, beta two would be that if there was an immediate jump or an immediate decrease in the utilization of hospitalizations as a result of that policy change. So what we found was that schizophrenic patients use a lot of healthcare, and I guess no one would be surprised to hear that. Now, if you look at the total claims for office visits, we actually saw 166 plus thousand office visits in the CPT codes that are listed there. And what we were told initially was that was all services utilization, so we assumed that those mental health visits were in there. In blue at the bottom, you'll see that we found another 58, almost 59,000 visits from the CPT codes that come from this 90801 through 05, which should have been pretty much everybody and their brother should have known that, right? Well, we had an expert panel, and everybody just assumed, and nobody looked far enough to figure that out. So we apologize for that, but we do have some preliminary results. Any psychiatrists in the room or people that bill under these codes? No one on our panel was actually a psychiatrist. We had people that worked in mental health, people at Medicaid, and everywhere else, and it just slipped through the crack. So let's look first at emergency room visits, and this is just graphic representation of per patient, ER visits per patient per month. And if you just look at it graphically, it just doesn't look like a lot happened during the study period. One of the things you can note, it looks like there's more of a trend in the pre-policy period than in the post-policy, but in post-policy there are a lot more fluctuations in our data. So we did the analysis, and what we found was that the model was significant, and if you'll look at the parsimonious model, which is just the model with only the significant variables in it, that the post-policy trend was minus 0.0021. What that simply means is there was a declining rate of emergency room visits in the post-policy period. Now, to look at the rest of the analysis for time series, we had two problems. Number one, all the statistics that you use to evaluate whether the time series model is appropriate or not indicated it was not appropriate, but we still don't believe that 100%, because what we looked at is we believed we saw some probably seasonality, some seasonal changes in the data, which is going to be important when I get to my conclusion. So just kind of keep that in mind. The problem was, because we could only get data up till April of 2006, we didn't have enough time periods to do a seasonal time series model. So looking next at office visits, again, it's a very similar graph, the per patient per month chart. Visually, it doesn't show you a lot. And again, that was one of the reasons why we began to undertake this study, was to see, because we really didn't know what was going on with the policy. And at least from the board's perspective, we did not want to be responsible for or recommend making recommendations related to a policy that was having a negative impact. For office visits, there was no significant findings. So there were no changes between the pre- and post-policy period. Now, here's the psych office visits. And if you look at it, this is all of them. From beginning to end, there's the intervention, and that's just a trend line through the entire period. So it looks like it was a pretty constant trend forward. Now, if we break it down into the pre- and the post-policy periods, and we look at the trend line equation for those, you can see that the actual trend in the post-policy period was less than in the pre-policy period, which leads us to believe that for the category of office visits, that we may have actually seen some decline for psychiatric office visits as opposed to office visits in general. We will do this both ways. We'll incorporate these psych visits into the overall office visit model, as well as looking at them independent to determine what went on with the psych office visits. As far as hospital admissions, again, you look at the chart, and visually it looks like there's maybe a slight upward trend there or not. And when it came to hospitalizations, again, the trend was a slight negative trend. Again, the test for autocorrelation or the time series nature of the data were not indicative of a time series model, but we hold out the possibility that with longer periods of data, we might see some seasonality in this data. Again, I'll talk about that when we get to the conclusions. For length of stay, there were no differences. And again, these charts all look very similar. The utilization in the pre-periods and post-periods looking pretty flat, but there being a little bit more variability in the post-periods. So there's two ways we can look at that. And first is to look at the absolute difference. And what we saw was that for hospital visits, we saw an actual decline of about 509 hospital visits per month in the post-policy period, which is a fairly significant number of office visits in this population. The relative difference, or how much it changed related to the trend that was existing in the pre-policy period, was about minus 20%. So a 20% decline in office visits. As far as hospital admissions, we saw about the same thing, 121 less hospital admissions and about a 22% decline relative to the pre-policy period. So the no significant changes in the office visits or length of stay. And we do have to include the analysis of the psychiatric offices before we can make any firm conclusions about that. But based on our preliminary analysis, it looks like it's going to be either supportive of or strengthening the results that we've already obtained. So the significant declines in the post-policy trend for ER visits and hospital visits, if you think about what's going on here, if our patients were getting sicker, if they were having more problems, they would have been in the ER, they would have been in the hospital more, and they probably would have seen their primary care or their psychiatric physicians more frequently. So we think the results are at least consistent with respect to the findings. Now, and this would seem to indicate that prior authorization did not have a negative impact on the schizophrenic patients in the state of Georgia. But we've got to remember a couple of things here, and I want to qualify it carefully because I think this is important. The psych office visits not being incorporated, that's critical. Those have got to be in the model. Because it was a Medicaid population, we used only continuously eligible, which leaves out a lot of people who may have entered and left the system. So we can't draw conclusions about that. And beyond that, because of the grandfathering, we have the issue of, well, nobody really had to change their medicine, and so it only impacted the patients who switched medicines, so to speak. So you need to keep that in mind as you look at who this policy really impacted. Now, Perhaps the more interesting question might be, what happened to patients who switched, or what, you know, those might be more interesting questions, but that was not our focus. Our focus was to look at what the impact of this generous prior authorization policy had on the Medicaid program in Georgia. So we did answer that question. Okay, the other thing is this declining trend, and now let's tie this back to what I said about the seasonality of the time series model. We noticed a declining trend. Now that's not sustainable for very long. I mean, trends can only go down so far, ultimately reaching zero, and we know that's never going to be the case, which is again support for our contention that we think there may be a seasonal trend that was going on. So we do need to look at these data over longer periods of time. That is going to be a much more complicated study because of the fact of managed care, because of Medicare Part D and everything else. So our populations are going to get smaller and smaller as we begin to make those evaluations. And the other thing is that we don't know what might have gone on with regard to other disease areas, for example, bipolar or the impact on children. Our population did not contain anyone under the age of 18 or over 65. So with those limitations, I feel comfortable saying that, you know, we feel like the prior authorization policy that Georgia implemented, again, a very generous prior authorization policy, did not appear to have a negative impact on Medicaid schizophrenic patients in the state of Georgia. So thank you.
So if the speakers want to come up, we definitely have time for questions.
Yeah. I have a question about the Georgia Medicaid study. Mm-hmm. As you know, the public mental health system in Georgia, it has been going through major upheavals over the past decade or so. And it's gotten to the point where it's extraordinarily difficult to hospitalize an individual with schizophrenia who's on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And those difficulties began around the early 2000 period. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, how are you able to attribute any changes that you observe to this single policy, given that the Georgia system is in such extraordinary disarray?
Well, your question really has a couple of parts to it, because this it is important to look at the adult mental health system as well as Medicaid. My understanding, and I hope it's correct, is that in the adult mental health system, there are a certain number of hospitalizations that occur outside the Medicaid system, and that may be a result of the things that you were mentioning. But what we wanted to do was, these trends that you're mentioning, there are others as well, more drugs coming to the marketplace, the population of the Medicaid division growing. So we had a lot of issues that were confounding, but because we believe them to be the result from resulting from